Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a U.S. Army veteran who served three tours in Afghanistan and just handed back his medals in protest at the NATO summit in Chicago. Jacob George joins us to explain why he handed back his medals and how he feels about the blood and treasure the U.S. has invested in a country that NATO is anxious to leave. Then we'll look into the impasse between NATO and Pakistan over opening the supply routes into Afghanistan, where the Pakistanis are gouging NATO, demanding a raise from $250 per vehicle to $5,000 per vehicle. And the president is refusing to apologize to the Pakistanis because that would be an election year gift to Mitt Romney, who has accused Obama of having a foreign policy of apologizing. Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the State Department Bureau of Intelligence and Research, joins us. Then finally, we will speak with the son of a former head of the CIA, William Colby, who opened up to Congress and spilled the family jewels, leading to the Church Committee reforms that created the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees. Documentary filmmaker Carl Colby, who recently made The Man Who Nobody Knew, In Search of My Father, CIA Spymaster William Colby, joins us to discuss how the post-9/11 so-called reforms are working and the ongoing military takeover of the CIA and American intelligence. Joining us now is Jacob George, who has served three tours in Afghanistan with the United States Army and is now taking part in demonstrations against NATO in Chicago, where yesterday he and other veterans returned medals that they had been awarded for their service in Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob George.
Well, thanks for having me.
And describe what you did yesterday in terms of handing back your medals. Where did it happen, and what kind of a ceremony, if that's the right word, took place?
Well, basically, we got as close to the NATO summit as we were allowed to. And what happened was we carried a U.S. flag with us on the march there, and some Afghan women from Afghans for Peace carried an Afghan flag, and we carried it side by side to show solidarity with each other. And then we brought them up onto the stage, where we were allowed to stage outside the NATO summit, and we folded our flag and presented it to the mother of a soldier that had fallen and pledged to continue our work as war resistors and anti-war veterans until these wars are brought to an end. And then we ceremoniously returned our medals, one service member at a time, and we said a little bit about why we were doing this with each person that went up.
And who did you return the medals to, Jacob George?
Well, we didn't really return them. We basically threw them as close as we could to the NATO summit. We weren't allowed to get too close. So it was more reminiscent of the action that took place in around the Vietnam veterans. That's where we drew our inspiration, and it was very similar to that. We actually had to throw them instead of handing them to a general. No representative from NATO agreed to come out and accept them.
So, Jacob George, what were the medals? You served three tours in Afghanistan, and the other service members that handed back their medals, were they Afghan vets as well?
No, there was a variety of veterans. It was Iraq and Afghanistan, and there was a variety of medals that were returned as well. And I actually don't know how many were returned and which ones. Because everyone had something different they wanted to turn in for different personal reasons.
So as a veteran, though, when you what was going on the inside there that you were shut out from, the one thing that we've learned is that there's a date certain they're going to pull out, although we don't know how many U.S. troops are going to be left behind. And there also is an impasse, as you know, over the supply routes that go through Pakistan, and the supplies aren't getting in. They're only getting in by air and via this Russia and the stands. And the Pakistanis are jacking the price up from $250 per vehicle to $5,000. You know, the war is incredibly unpopular with the American people. As a veteran there, what do you come away with? What was your service and sacrifice about?
That's a really good question, and I think that's a question that a lot of us as veterans there ask ourselves, you know, what did we really do and what did we really accomplish? And unfortunately, there isn't enough transparency in the Department of Defense and what's actually happened and the gains that are really being made and lost in order to draw a true critical analysis on that. So all we can do is draw from our personal experiences. And on that, I would have to say that for most of us, it's a major loss. We didn't really gain a whole lot from this war other than these experiences that we have now, unfortunately.
And do you think, though, that there is anything that could have been done? I mean, many people that I speak to that have spent time in Afghanistan basically say, well, first of all, it's worth pointing out that 90% of the GDP, the budget of Afghanistan, is paid for by the United States and NATO. So we're basically the only, you know, 90% of the economy of Afghanistan is on our dime. But most people say that have spent time there is that you can't really do nation building there because, you know, it's just the culture and the history is such that they just want to be left alone. What's your reading on what the Afghans want?
Well, I think you're pretty accurate on saying that this might be a dubious effort for nation building because, one, the U.S. military isn't designed to build nations. It's designed to destroy them. Unfortunately. And in terms of what I think Afghans want, I really can't speak to that directly. I've heard many different opinions on what Afghans want. One of the main things I heard, because I went back to Afghanistan last summer, actually, as a civilian to work with Afghan youth. And one of the things I heard from a lot of Afghans was that they would like to have a stabilization force there, but they would like it to be an all-Muslim peacekeeping force that would be more likely to be respectful to the cultural sensitivities of Afghan culture, which are very diverse. And we're frankly not trained to observe that as U.S. soldiers and most in NATO. So that's one thing that everyone seemed to be really concerned about when we were talking to them, was some type of stabilization force that was sensitive to the culture in Afghanistan and all its differences.
Well, my understanding is that just in terms of the war effort and the cost in blood and treasure, it may be that most of that equipment that we brought in, and there's an awful lot of heavy equipment there that came in via Pakistan, we may not be able to get it out. I mean, the Pakistanis and the U.S., the bottom line with what's going on between Obama and the Pakistanis is that they're demanding an apology, and Obama simply can't give an apology because that would be a gift to Mitt Romney, who's already accusing him of apologizing too much. So that's the standoff. From what you've seen and experienced there as a veteran, Jacob George, what kind of equipment could we be leaving behind? There's an awful lot of stuff that we put in there, isn't there?
Yeah, that's an incredible amount of equipment. And I have to tell you that I did three tours over there between 2001 and 2004, my first one being about a month after September 11th. And back then, there was an incredible amount of equipment there. And, you know, we've been there for 10 years now. And we've gone through an entire generation of people and an entire evolution of how our military is operating over there. Almost every piece of equipment that I used while I was there is now outdated and something else is being used there. So we are talking about a enormous load of equipment to bring back. There is a possibility some of it could be left there. You know, that's exactly what I encountered when I was there in 2001, 2002. Was the relics of the Soviet occupation. They're all over the country. I'm pretty sure a lot of the stuff is still there. Actually, it was when I went back last summer. There's still tanks all over the place. So it might just be some more grim decorations to what people call the graveyard of empires.
Again, I'm speaking with Jacob George, who served three tours in Afghanistan with the United States Army and is now taking part in demonstrations against NATO in Chicago, where yesterday he and other veterans returned medals that they were awarded for their service in Afghanistan. Going back, you just mentioned you came in into Afghanistan in the first month after the U.S. went in there in 2001 following the September 11th attacks. A lot of people have said, you know, including, by the way, candidate Barack Obama and now President Obama, he basically made the argument in the election that George Bush took his eye off the ball and never finished the job in Afghanistan and went into this disastrous war in Iraq instead, and that's why we've been in trouble ever since. As a veteran, what's your interpretation of what happened and what went wrong?
Well, as much as I don't want to place blame on anyone for this in particular, I will have to say that the Taliban was effectively toppled within 6 months of us being in that country and removed from power. And one of the things I've always questioned about this, and again, you know, I don't have enough of the bigger picture to know this, but why did we stay there longer than that? Unfortunately, I don't think we'll ever really know the answer to that question, but we could have left shortly after that and still accomplished just almost everything we wanted to accomplish. For the most part, one of the reasons I say that is because it was in the beginning a CIA-led operation. There were CIA operatives on the ground working with Special Operations Forces, which is one of the first times this has happened in a long time. And what that means is there was a very light military footprint, which means we could have easily gotten out of there just as easily as we got in. But unfortunately now, 10 years later, it's not going to be as easy to leave, as you have pointed out.
So is that to say then that our heavy footprint, all the boots on the ground, a Christian army in Muslim lands, is that a part of the problem itself?
Well, I think the inability to be culturally sensitive to a lot of the Muslim cultures in Afghanistan is definitely a huge problem. And a military that does have a predominant Christian presence is something that can look slightly insulting when people are ignorantly, I don't think purposely, burning religious texts. And, you know, in Afghanistan, a lot of things travel by word of mouth. You know, people share stories, they talk to each other a lot. That's how a lot of news and information is shared. So when things like this happen, you know, they spread as rumors, and there's simply no way to rebuild our image when stuff like that happens, especially given that we are seen as a predominantly Christian military in a Muslim land.
Well, just in closing, Jacob George, given that you handed in your medals yesterday in front of the meeting where the NATO summit was taking place with President Obama and all of the heads of NATO, the 28 countries there, along with the president of Pakistan, Zardari, who the president met with briefly today, and of course, Afghan President Hamid Karzai. My understanding is that a lot of the demonstrations that took place were fairly, I mean, most of the demonstrations that took place were quite peaceful both yesterday and today. But there was this element of the black bloc, the anarchists. That did you witness any of that? Because looking before I talked to you, ABC News had a report saying that the very dignified ceremony that you and your comrades handing back their medals was marred by the black bloc. Did that take place?
Well, I think there's a little bit of clarification needed there, but not a whole lot. What happened was we did our march. Everything was incredibly peaceful. It was amazing. The police were respectful. Protesters were respectful. We were all singing together. Well, I don't know if the cops were singing with us, but definitely someone was smiling at us and giving us a thumbs up, which felt really nice. That's the type of solidarity that we need to really build a movement. And then we went to the stage, and I was standing on the stage after we folded the flag, and I actually watched the flood of the black bloc start to move through the middle of the crowd toward the stage, because everyone was dressed in black, had their faces wrapped, you know, and flags raised, and they were fairly calm and peaceful. And when we were folding the flag, there was a lot of chanting that said burn it, but we were folding it to present it to a mother, so that wasn't going to happen. After we finished up, we went off stage, and the officers issued order for disbursement, and we had already left the area. We were in a park a couple of blocks away, and that's when I guess the struggles started to break out. But that actually, none of that happened until after everything was wrapped up. So everything was pretty respected in terms of the ceremony. And I think it was the order for disbursement that really instigated a lot of the clashing that happened.
Well, Jacob George, I thank you so much for joining us here today. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Jacob George, who has served three tours in Afghanistan with the United States Army and is now taking part in demonstrations against NATO in Chicago, where yesterday he and other veterans returned medals that they had been awarded for their service in Afghanistan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marvin Weinbaum, who was the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003. He was a senior fellow at the United States Institute for Peace and held a Fulbright Research Fellowship for Afghanistan and Egypt. Marvin Weinbaum is an emeritus professor at the University of Illinois, where he directs the program in South Asian and Middle East Studies and has authored numerous books, including The Future of Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marvin Weinbaum.
Yes, hello there.
And apparently the president did have a very sort of brief and cursory meeting with the Pakistani President Zardari today, at the close of the NATO summit, and clearly there's a lot of tension between the United States and Pakistan, and including NATO as well, by the way, about the closure of the supply routes to get equipment and supplies into Afghanistan in the NATO's long war there in Afghanistan. Do you think that there's any way that this could possibly be solved in an election year, where the Pakistanis are demanding an apology? And if the president were to apologize, that would be handing Mitt Romney a gift, because Mitt Romney's already gone public saying that Obama's foreign policy is to go and apologize to everyone.
Yes, first of all, let me say that the gesture to Zardari, which wasn't anticipated, is largely because Zardari, there's no reason to offend Zardari. Zardari has been, over the last 4 years, practically, the best person that we've had in enunciating our concerns in Pakistan. He doesn't carry very much weight there, but there's no reason to offend him. The larger question, though, is, as you rightly put it, can we, in this year, see some progress? I think ultimately we will. It's just taken an inordinately long time because it's caught up not on the issues themselves, it's not really that much about the price of each lorry which is going into Afghanistan, or the apology issue, or for that matter, even the drone issue, because these are the kinds of issues that diplomats generally are able to negotiate on and come to a reasonable conclusion for both sides. Not everyone gets everything they want, naturally. But what is standing in the way is, of course, the fact that not just on our side are there political pressures, but there are clearly even stronger ones on the Pakistan side. The Islamists there and also the major opposition party have indicated that any resumption of the supply route is going to be met with a mass march across the country, and that they have made veiled threats that they're going to indeed try to disrupt that line of supply.
Well, that has happened on a number of occasions. Every time there's been a problem between the U.S. and Pakistan, the trucks have been attacked and the tankers have been blown up. It's not difficult to assume that there's some kind of tit-for-tat arrangement there with the Pakistani security forces, ISI, whatever, to arrange for the sabotage. Now you're saying these are political parties who are threatening to sabotage the supply route.
These are not just political, the jihadi groups in the country. They go under the name of the Defense of Pakistan Council, and they are a grouping of some of the most dangerous groups in Pakistan. And so if there is a sabotage of the supply lines, it's going to be far more serious. Before, what we did together with the Pakistan security forces is we bought off people. Yes, there were occasions when they were attacked, but everybody prospered to some extent from this. Criminal elements along the way, everybody got protection money. We're talking about something far more serious if, in fact, there is a resumption. That has to be factored into what's happening. Let me just say, in the larger context, the very breakdown of the relationship with Pakistan, the loss of faith between the two countries, the discovery that we really don't have that much in common when it comes to the future of the region. We do have some in common, and that's going to be the basis for any hope of resuming a normal relationship. But there is so much that divides us here that it really stands in the way of our having the kind of trust that would lead both sides to be able to enter negotiations in good faith.
Again, I'm speaking with Marvin Weinbaum, who was a former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003, and he's the author of The Future of Afghanistan. The Pakistani demands are a public apology for the killing of the 24 Pakistani soldiers following the cross-border incident between the U.S. and Pakistan, for which the U.S. has refused to apologize, and as we mentioned, this is an election year, and Obama simply can't hand Romney the gift of an apology because that's Romney's foreign policy campaign in terms of his television campaign. He's already been accusing Obama of apologizing to other countries. So that's a frozen issue.
Let me mention that we were on the verge of making what would have amounted to an apology several months ago. What happened was there then was an attack in Kabul, a very serious attack, and that was traced by most intelligence sources back to Pakistan and to this Haqqani group there. And that put a kibosh, really, on that overture to the Pakistanis. The president was prepared at that point to take some of the heat just in order to get things back on an even keel with Pakistan. But once that occurred, that really then, I think, torpedoed any kind of strictly speaking, apology.
And the other issues under review are the U.S. policy on drone attacks inside Pakistan, and then a large increase in the current transit charges, which are currently $250 per vehicle of supplies coming in through Pakistan into Afghanistan. Apparently, the President Obama is unhappy about the fees that we already pay, and he's quite incensed by the price that the Pakistanis are trying to jack it up to. Is there any way that you can bribe them into submission, or has this become too hot a political potato inside Pakistan?
Again, I think that this is something that can be worked out if there's goodwill on both sides. They're asking for $5,000 against the current supposedly $250 that we're paying. Now, it's costing us more to keep the alternative going through the northern route, which goes through the Stans and Russia and out to Europe. So it's not the money so much, but it's the idea that it's being held hostage. And that, too, could become a political issue, that they have squeezed this out of us. It's, again, not the dollar amount. It's more the idea of being blackmailed in this fashion by them. I do think, though, that they'll come to terms on this issue. The apology is a kind of zero-sum game. Either you do or you don't. That's going to be tougher unless they're willing to settle for something which is the most sincere of apologies. Most sincere of regrets, rather. Sorry.
Sure. Well, but all of this makes, from what you've told us so far, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, is it makes one wonder who's in charge in Pakistan. And, of course, that's a perennial issue, isn't it? It's the old joke is that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And you've got these political parties now, Nawaz Sharif jockeying to take over. You've got a lame duck president who is widely detested and considered a completely incompetent. And as you mentioned earlier, at least President Obama didn't humiliate him today by having him join in the photo op and have a brief chat with him, along with Karzai. But the long and short, he doesn't have any power. The popular sentiment there, from my understanding, is deeply anti-American.
Indeed, it is very anti-American. Let me say something interesting has occurred in this negotiation. Normally, this would be negotiations would be handled by the Pakistan military. What they did in this case was they pushed it on to the civilians and the parliament. And this was done as much as anything to have them be the heavies here and to make certain that those demands were going to be ones which they could then turn around and say, look, we can't back away because, you see, the country is demanding that we get the drones stopped, that we get an extraordinary price for allowing you to send those trucks through. So they've allowed them to take the heat here, and the political types who might ordinarily have said enough is enough, let's get on with it, are now feeling public opinion breathing down their back, and that's made this much more complicated. Whereas in the past, policy elites would simply get together and work out the details.
But, of course, the United States does give a lot of aid to Pakistan, and even that aid itself, the Kerry bill, was it Kerry Lugar? Which was a substantial amount of money. That became a hot political issue, and the Pakistani media were talking about how the U.S. are trying to take over their country via Blackwater, and the money was was all to destabilize the country instead of try and build civilian institutions, which is what it was.
But you know, one of the demands that the Pakistanis have made is that, yes, you're giving the civilian aid, the Carrie Lugar Berman bill, you're giving that, but the truth is most of it never gets here, and most of it has not been spent. And with respect to the military assistance, one of the complaints that they have now is, even though they're supposed to be getting something like $1.3 billion a year to carry on the fight against the extremists, we actually have not been passing that money on to them for some time now. And they claim that we're in arrears of up to $3 billion on that. We claim it's not quite that much. But here's another issue. We are holding that money back in this period because of our unhappiness with Pakistan's policy. So it's not as though they're getting everything and we're relenting on very much here. We have played hardball with them.
Well, yeah, but if this is a game of poker, we're playing hardball, but they're calling our bluff.
They are, but the military is hurting, even though that's a small part of their overall budget. Nevertheless, that amount of money is not the chicken feed, and it's money that they have come to depend on in their own military operations. So they do want to see a resumption of that. And also, we're talking here about military equipment, which we supply them with. So the military cannot allow this, I think, to go on indefinitely. At some point, they're going to, just as they did in the Davis affair, they pushed it.
Davis was the CIA guy that was caught.
The CIA guy who shot a couple of Pakistanis in February, I guess it was, of last year.
Right.
After having really provoked the public here into anger, then when it had gone too far, then they called off the dogs. Suddenly, a deal was arranged, bringing the Saudis in, and money suddenly appeared to satisfy the families of the victims. So they do have that ability, but I think the situation has changed enough in Pakistan these days where you can also say that the military has to some degree lost control over areas that it used to have a very tight command, and because in the past anything having to do with foreign affairs or security issues was totally in the realm of the military. That's not quite as true today as it used to be.
Again, I'm speaking with Marvin Weinbaum, who was the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003, and he's the author of The Future of Afghanistan. You mentioned, about the supply routes they've jacked up the Pakistanis. The increase is, previously we were being charged $250 per vehicle, and now they've jacked it up to $5,000 per vehicle. There's a huge backlog, and we're having to fly a lot of stuff in, which is very expensive. And as you say, the northern route through Russia and the stands is even more expensive. So this opens up the question, though, of now that the NATO summit, the statement from the NATO summit is a definite date that they are going to withdraw. That was the one piece of news that came out of it that was quite unanimous, that we're getting the hell out of there. Now, how are they going to get all that heavy equipment out?
Well, this will be a concern. We do have time yet. We'd be looking at that next year, and certainly in 2014, will become a serious matter. We will, by that point, I think we will have settled this. But the larger issue here is getting out. Yet what that means here is, first of all, we'll see that the NATO forces, and that includes the United States, of course, will no longer take the lead in military operations and combat operations after next summer. That's been pretty well established now. And something which was agreed on in Lisbon in 2010 has been reaffirmed by this conference that took place in Chicago today, and that is that the military operations entirely of NATO will end by the December of 2014. What has been added to that now is the strategic agreement, which is signed between the United States and the Afghans, which, if once the details are laid out, could have the U.S. leaving behind a residual force of 15, 20, 25,000 troops, not for combat, but for training. At the same time, let me say that they'll be there able to defend themselves if they have to, but they would not be involved in combat. That can work in that kind of capacity, but only if the Afghan military remains loyal to the government and competent enough to stave off attacks by the Taliban. That's a big if now. We're not at all confident about that. If they can, then that force can play a very important role because it can tell the Taliban that, look, don't wait around to take over this place. We're going to be here. We're going to be here with economic assistance, development assistance, as well as we're going to have troops on the ground. So you just don't count on simply taking over this country after 2014.
But just in closing, the Taliban could reply to that, well, we've got Pakistan on our side, and they're going to really determine the future. Just on the other issue of the Afghan army, nobody said that anything particularly optimistic about the state of that army. And my understanding is that one third of NATO casualties have come from friendly fire, from people that we've been training have turned their guns on us.
Well, that one third is true, but that suggests that, fortunately, our casualties over the last several months have been very low. So, what has happened in the way of a friendly fire, as you call it, has been a large proportion of that. About Pakistan, I think we have to recognize that Pakistan is not anxious to see the Taliban score a complete victory in Afghanistan. It's for all that it uses the Afghan Taliban, it is fearful that if they were to return and monopolized power, consolidated power in the country, what would then happen is that they would very likely then turn back on Pakistan in support of the Pakistani Taliban, a group which did not exist in the 1990s. So they really would prefer to see in Afghanistan not a Taliban victory, but a political solution. That's their optimal policy, and they've been working for that. The trouble is that they can't get the Afghan Taliban to accept terms that aren't really ones that effectively turn the country back over to them. Let me be a little clearer on that. What they can't get the Afghans to agree to the kind of compromise that would lead them into a coalition government, into a power-sharing arrangement with those who now are in power in the country. And their failure to do that means, at the moment, Pakistan is kind of caught. It doesn't have really a good solution.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, who was the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003. He was a senior fellow at the United States He was a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace and held Fulbright Research Fellowships for Afghanistan and Egypt, and is an emeritus professor at the University of Illinois, where he directs the program in South Asian and Middle East Studies. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the son of the CIA spymaster who spilled the family jewels. Joining us now is Carl Colby, a director and producer and an award-winning documentary filmmaker who has made films on subjects such as Franz Kline, William de Kooning, Bob Marley, Frank Gehry, George Jarrell, and Franco Zeffirelli. His latest film, a feature-length documentary, is about his father, the man nobody knew, in search of my father, CIA spymaster William Colby. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Colby.
Thank you, Ian.
And your documentary, feature-length documentary that you made about your father is really more than it's an extraordinary personal story about growing up and having this mysterious father. But the heart of the story is a huge story about the post-war role of intelligence and, of course, culminating in the Vietnam War. And then the whole expose that followed that, where your father testified endlessly before the church committee and other committees. There's a new book out now by Hank Crumpton that suggests that the entire culture of the CIA was affected by what happened with those hearings, and that a significant percentage of the American elite from whom the CIA had drawn its initial recruits turned against the war and against the intelligence community. Do you think it is a different CIA as a result of that era?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the initial CIA, you know, came out of OSS, and my father was on the sort of paramilitary side of OSS, Jed Berg, you know, parachuting into occupied France and Norway and working with local resistance leaders to, you know, combat the Nazis. And so it's very romantic, and in some ways, you know, sad to say, but maybe a bit simplistic. You know, you go in and you into an area which is being occupied by Nazis, and obviously they were not native to France or native to Norway, so you might get the support of the local populace quite more readily than you would, obviously, if you're paratrooping into North Vietnam and you're saying that you're in support of South Vietnamese. Well, they're all Vietnamese. And so it certainly is colored in the early days by OSS. And then the mid-period, I think, that you're talking about, those hearings really did affect it, because they were sort of turned into kind of a bloodletting of the CIA right around my father's period, and he was asked to fire hundreds of senior officers, and Nixon really distrusted the CIA. He thought they were a bunch of pointy-headed kind of liberal intellectuals all having cocktails in Georgetown and coming up with theories and not really doing what the president wants. And it's quite explicit, and it comes across quite frankly in the film, that Nixon really thought the CIA worked for him, I mean, directly, and tried to implicate them in, obviously, the Watergate break-in, and really thought of them as their own tool, which then the CIA and my father, but particularly Richard Helms and Vernon Walters, who was the deputy at the time, really pushed away from that idea. And I think the result of that was quite strange, because then you ended a period, really, in the 70s and 80s when, you know, America had been defeated in the Vietnam War. The mood in America was really quite against, you know, covert action. And so you almost had also the kind of professionalization of being a spy. You know, the romantic notion, the Harry Lime, that sort of character disappeared, and suddenly you had a fellow who, you know, was taking his kids to soccer practice and still reporting at headquarters every day for a job. Well, it's not really a desk-type job. And now you see the impulse to go back, really, in the CIA to the more OSS spirit. And I think that's where you're also getting a quite interesting, almost ironic mix of, rather than the CIA becoming militarized, it's as if the Pentagon and the military is becoming more intelligence-driven and much more special operations-focused. I mean, look at what we're doing now in the Horn of Africa and in Afghanistan and all. You know, we don't have these big standing armies, or at least we're trying to rid ourselves of it. You know, we have these special operation groups going in and doing things. We're doing using a lot of drones. I mean, this administration is more active in that program than any other combined. So it's a quite interesting shift, really. And so you do have a military man, Petraeus, going in to run CIA. But the more interesting mix would be to look at how the military itself is operating like an intelligence operation. They know the American public won't support great large ground wars, and so we're now engaged in an awful lot of precision targeting and that sort of thing. But the big question you might ask, or certainly the politicians should be asking, is, number one, you know, morally and legally, should we even be doing this sort of thing? And number two is, what does it mean in the long run? I mean, if you can eliminate a few characters here and there, even Mr. Rodriguez, the CIA head of special operations, the other day was on television saying, so it was bad to torture Al-Qaeda, but not to kill them? I mean, now we're killing them. So it's a conundrum. It's a difficult mix we're in right now, and I think sure. we could use a lot more dialogue.
Well, with Carl Colby, Rodriguez, of course, is refuted by the people who actually did the torturing in the case of Ali Soufran at the FBI and Glenn Carl at the CIA. Both have gone public saying the whole program was a complete and absolute disaster and there was no actionable intelligence. And in Glenn Carl's case, he was in charge of a black site where they had supposedly the number three Al-Qaeda guy. And from day one, he knew he was the wrong guy. And as he kept telling headquarters, which is Rodriguez, and they're operating on a finding, which is John Yoo's letter, no presidential finding, just this letter from John Yoo. Carl kept saying, we got the wrong guy. And they said, no, he's just avoiding. You've got to enhance the interrogation. Mm-hmm. And they kept this guy chained in a cellar for like 6 years, I think. And finally, mm-hmm. when Obama came in, they let him loose. And of course, he was completely innocent. And you know the price we paid around the world. So it sort of leads you to what's going on now is these different versions of histories. The neocons are promoting Rodriguez and Hank Crumpton, who was on CNN blaming Clinton for everything and not Bush.
Right.
And then you have the people like Glenn Carl and Ali Soufran doing the opposite. So
it's a lot of, you know, recriminations aside. I mean, I think what it really calls to mind is, you know, why aren't we having this dialogue? I mean, Senator Patrick Leahy, I interviewed him, and it's in the extra scenes of the DVD, and he says, what are we afraid of? I mean, in a sense, what are we American people afraid of? If we don't like a program, if we feel it's immoral or illegal, we shouldn't do it and live with the consequences and really conduct ourselves as Americans. And yet you don't see this, you don't feel this, and you don't sense any outrage. You certainly sense it in the American public and in the media with you and people like other very perceptive, you know, dogged reporters and journalists, but you don't see it as much in the halls of Congress. You seem sort of more of an accepting atmosphere, and yet you wonder, you know, is this going to be really to our detriment later when this precision sort of killing, you know, what does it lead to ultimately? I mean, I guess it leads to just a sense of being kind of a vigilant policeman, but forever. You know, what is the goal? And it's not really being sold to the American people. It's not being, I don't think, explained very well by the administration or any administration as to, you know, what's the end game here.
Again, I'm speaking with Carl Colby, who has made this new feature-length documentary, The Man Nobody Knew, In Search of My Father, CIA Spymaster William Colby. You mentioned earlier Nixon's suspicion of the CIA, and he wanted to have his own personal police force. Incidentally, he did. That's why he created the Drug Enforcement Administration.
That's why Elvis, I guess, is in the Oval Office.
Right.
There's another good book out now, as you know, Tim Weiner's Enemies book, which is quite interesting on the history of the FBI. But it is fascinating, you know, why are we not having this larger dialogue and how dangerous it can be in the hands of the wrong president or, frankly, any president, to have this, in a sense, secret army and unaccountable to anyone else. And you might wonder, why is our oversight process maybe not a little bit more strict? I do hear, though, that the the Senate and the House, the one thing they seem to agree on is intelligence now. They seem to blend well. I mean, what I know of the, and I've spoken to the staff directors on the different intelligence groups, committees, and they seem to blend well. They seem to work well, even though they're controlled by different political parties. But I think there's a sense that in foreign affairs and military affairs, there seems to be a growing sort of consensus. And yet, I still feel that there's not a real vocal dialogue, you know, on these issues. And
well, but it's worth pointing out, Carl Colby, that it was your father's testimony that resulted in the formation of the oversight committees in both the Senate and the House.
Yeah, I mean, ways, you know, I often ask audiences, and it'd be great, you know, if people see the DVD, you know, they can ask themselves the questions as to, you know, did he do the right thing? I mean, did he follow his conscience, or is he naive? Is he just wrong-headed? How can you possibly have a secret organization and have any openness at all, have any oversight at all? And it's fascinating. Even personal friends or colleagues of his would say to him, I read a recent biography of Richard Helms, and Helms just vilified him at the end, saying, my father was just giving away the store. He was telling Congress things that nobody needed to tell them. And yet, I think my father felt he was, if he had to be loyal to one thing, it had to be the U.S. Constitution. It couldn't be the president, particularly one who was disgraced.
Well, but your personal story is so extraordinary, though, that, you know, you grow up in these countries like Italy, and you see your father leaving with briefcases full of cash and a whole bunch of, cardinals or bishops from the Vatican hanging out of the house and trying to put it all together about what's going on. And then, 30, 40 years later, you find out what was really going on?
Right. Yeah, no, it was very exciting. In some ways, I didn't want to know I didn't really want to know some things earlier on. And then I thought, well, the hell with it. You know, get to the bottom of it as much as you can.
So your father died in a very dramatic way. And again, his death led to a lot of conspiracy theories because he was at paddling his canoe and on the Chesapeake, and there were all kinds of theories, even Russians, you know, frogmen nabbing him,
right,
and all this kind of stuff. The film has still a little bit of ambivalence about what happened there. Can you walk us through that again?
Well, I can walk you through one sense, is that I think he was he had felt that I think he wasn't in a position to give any secrets out anymore. I mean, he certainly had enemies. You know, the North Vietnamese really did not care for him. The Russians, I think, that it, you know, those were professionals. I mean, I talked to Oleg Kalugin a few weeks ago, and he told me he didn't see anything that the Russians would have been doing with
him.
Sure.
Let me just mention that Oleg Kalugin, General Kalugin, was the resident, the top KGB guy in Washington for decades, and he came over originally as a Fulbright scholar, but I know him well. He's a good, interesting fellow.
Right. But I think it was more of a sense of I would call him, and I actually called him once, my dad, and said, and he was rambling a bit, you know, and I think he was sort of trying to connect in some way, you know. Not that I didn't speak to him, I mean, I would speak to him, but more curt sort of conversation. And he was searching and asking about, you know, had he done enough for my sister, you know, when she was ill, and just really almost like a summing up or an accounting, you know, a personal accounting that you take of your own life. And he was getting on a bit. I mean, 76 years old, it's not very old. But and then he said to me that, one of your friends, one of your old college buddies, was found under a bridge. He has advanced Alzheimer's and slept for the night under a bridge. And my father said, oh, well, that will never happen to me. And I said, oh, really? He says, yep. He says, one day you'll just hear that I was walking on a goat path along a Greek island and I fell to the sea. And I said, really? He said, yep, just like that. It's as if he wouldn't go quietly. And if he was going to go, he'd rather control it. I mean, if any of us think about our life, I mean, do you want to go and some untoward moment? I mean, it's as if he, I'm not saying he planned his own demise, but I think he had a sense, or at least when it came upon him, I think he knew. And I think there was always a control factor in him. I think he was very disturbed by being thrown out of the CIA when he was. I think that really upset his whole, just his whole being, really. He had been this ultimate company man, and they had done everything they'd ever asked him to do, taken every dirty assignment thrown at him. And then they throw him out for telling the truth, you know, for really being the good American. Mm. And I think it was a little bit too much.
Well, you know, I work with your father on, of all things, the California nuclear freeze. You recall during the Reagan administration, they weren't talking to the Russians, and the nuclear freeze movement resulted from a great deal of concern that the nuclear arms race were getting out of hands, and the Russians and the Americans weren't talking. And he made commercials for me,
right,
to promote the nuclear freeze, and he was motivated by having been in the CIA and known about stuff that's still secret to this day, about the many near misses that we had in the nuclear age. And the idea that you have a nuclear war on purpose is pretty insane.
Right.
But to have a nuclear war by accident, and he was absolutely convinced that one of these days, one of these damn things were going to go off because the controls simply weren't sufficient. And it's so interesting in retrospect that that argument is still going on. You know, just yesterday, General Cartwright, and the former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs and head of the U.S. nuclear forces, has called for a reduction down to 900 of nuclear weapons.
Right, I read that. And it's fascinating also that, let's say, George Shultz and Henry Kissinger and Bill Perry and Sam Nunn have all, you know, signed up for really, you know, the
zero nuclear weapons.
Ridding ourselves of nuclear weapons. I mean, it's quite interesting. You know, these are these ultimate power players. And yet, I think as they get older, they realize, as you say, they've had privileged information to see how many near misses or how sloppy some of these armaments may have been handled, particularly by the other side, and how, again, something could have slipped through the cracks. I mean, something could have been sold to somebody in the Ukraine, and God help us, you know. So I think there's really more of a sense of mortality and of how slipshod it all was. And also, I think these men and some women are really... they're very disturbed by sort of warmongering. They're very disturbed by the idea, oh, let's launch. You know, like, you don't hear that word shock and awe anymore. You know, that kind of idea that, oh, well, we'll just go out and obliterate the enemy and it'll all be wonderful and it'll be over. We don't, those conflicts don't exist anymore.
Sure.
And thank God we don't have people like that in office who are controlling things.
Well, Carl Colby, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Carl Colby. He's a director, producer, and award-winning documentary filmmaker who's made films about such subjects as Franz Kline, William de Kooning, Bob Marley, Frank Gehry, George Harrell, and Franco Zeffirelli. His latest film, a feature-length documentary, is about his father, the man nobody knew, In Search of My Father, CIA spymaster William Colby. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Christian Vasquez. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.